On Friday the 18th, just last Friday, a crowd of college-age anarchists, mostly white, destroyed a statue on public property in downtown Raleigh. It was a lark for them, jumping, smiling, laughing. A recent survey showed that some 58% of college-age Americans say that violence in protests are permissible. We no longer have a country where we can rely on law enforcement to protect us or our property. In the Raleigh case, two police cars were parked with visibility of the statue, but the police did not interfere. Only a driving rain that came up suddenly drove these violent thugs off the streets. This is fun and games for these undisciplined hordes. What's happening across the country has little to do with the George Floyd case. Justice is begun when an assailant has been arrested, charged, and jailed. Floyd's assailant has been arrested, charged, and jailed. Everyone has a right to a fair trial, but the protesters claim that right for themselves while trying to be judge and jury in the Flood case and others like it. None of us has that right. We do have the right to peaceful protest, but blocking the streets, rioting, looting, burning is not your right. Pay attention to the people we see on camera in these riots. They are the dregs of society, misfits who do not contribute but who take away. Before you shout, "Racist," remember I said most of these people tearing down statues are college-age whites. When the government allows just one of these violent acts, it encourages others. When a city mayor, like the loony liberal in Seattle, allows anarchists to block off 6 blocks of downtown and proclaim it as theirs, there is no turning back. That anarchy will and has spread. Black Lives Matter is not some group that just sprang up in protest instantaneously. They are a group determined to destroy this country. Most of the useful idiots marching along with them have no idea the sinister forces that are behind that movement. Again, their ranks are filled with college-age ne'er-do-wells who have been indoctrinated to the cause by professors who are more at home with communism than freedom. It is time to stop the insanity. If that means calling in the military to restore order, we have to do it. We'd like not to, but these anarchists are not going to go away. They can watch the violence and burning down of businesses and not miss one step in their march. A human life matters. The color of the skin of that human life does not matter. Innocent lives matter when they are policemen. Just as much. But when those lives are taken, the media pays little or no attention, and the hypocrisy of the protesters allows them to put that police life in their rearview mirror without a second thought. It is a fact that most police officers are killed each year by black assailants, more than black people are killed by police. So why is the focus solely on instances of white-on-black killings? Black lives matter. Tell that to the hundreds of thousands of black babies murdered in their mother's womb each year, or the black lives lost in America's major cities each weekend. Chicago is a killing field featuring blacks killing blacks, as many as 90 shot in a single weekend. Over Father's Day, more than 100 were shot, as many as 19 were killed this past weekend. In just one weekend. Tell that to the young black kids without a father and destined to grow up on the streets where they are more often to die or go to prison. There is no sustained outcry for those black lives by the group with Black Lives Matter signs. Police brutality is real, but not confined to black lives only. More white lives are lost in those circumstances than black. Why then is the media focused solely on police brutality involving blacks? Because it will divide us. It is human brutality. It knows no color, and it has to stop. The great majority of our police are good, hard-working Americans. Only an occasional few resort to brutality in arrests. Are there no bad apples in the gangs these officers have to try to control? I'm all for police reform, but those who demand defunding the police are naive or idiots. Take the police out of the inner city and there will not be enough coffins to bury the poor blacks who will be victimized. Enough is enough. It's hard to move on to other subjects as long as protesters and Antifa prolong the rhetoric words about race. We are watching our country be destroyed from the inside, just like communism predicted many decades ago. What good is a perfect society if the country is destroyed or set back so far that opportunities are scarce? I'll give you an example. Let's say a housefly lands on your refrigerator. Rather than try to understand how that fly got into the house and how to prevent it in the future, you grab a shotgun and blast the fly, destroying the refrigerator in the process. What did you gain? Please listen to this entire commentary before getting defensive. Both Black America and the white supremacists among us will share equal blame. We have a problem that landed on us decades ago, and it's called racism. Do we dwell into how it got in and how to prevent it in the future? Or do we destroy the future in order to solve the problem? That's where we are in America today with the problem of race. Everybody wants to flap their gums about it, but few want to have an honest discussion about it. We know how our pesky problem got in the House of the United States. Decades of slavery brought it to us. We did not create slavery, as Hillary Clinton's running mate just said. It was brought to us from Africa by slave traders who were aided and abetted by African leaders who sold their own race into slavery. For our part, it took longer than it should have for us to expel this monstrous evil from our midst. The Democrat Party dug in their heels and fought freedom from slavery to the end. It finally took a civil war to rid America of slavery. More than 600,000 white Union soldiers died in that war to end the practice of slavery. They have been mostly forgotten in the heated rhetoric today. The black slaves were given freedom, but little else. Because of their lowly station, most could not even read or write. Not because they were incapable of it, but because they had been forbidden to learn. They were considered to be inferior to white people. The government, under Democrat leadership, was willing to set up programs for them at taxpayer expense to move them from the slave plantations to political plantations controlled by the Democrats. But nobody concerned themselves with how the newly freed blacks could ever reach equality. If you are an educated person, and I am not, it is almost impossible to you to ever consider me your equal. Instead of setting up programs that required blacks to qualify by seeking education, liberal Democrats insisted on keeping them dependent on them and their government programs. Black families began to fall apart. Black children went fatherless in their homes. Today, it's not unusual to hear black women say they are single mothers with 2 to 6 children. Acts of Congress made fathers in the black community unnecessary. What are the odds for a black child born in the inner city with no father to lead them? All around them, they see poverty, drug dealers driving shiny new cars, and no hope for their own future. Rather than seek ways to get these children the education they will need to break the cycle, liberals find more programs to appease them. We have many white and black billionaires and multimillionaires in this country who could use some of their resources to find ways to educate these poor children. Oprah Winfrey is a billionaire, and she saw the need for black education. But instead of reaching out to the black children in America, Oprah founded a school for black girls in Africa. That was a kind humanitarian gesture, but with so many black children needing that education here in her own country, why put those resources into education in Africa? Perhaps it's because our laws, under them, she would not have been able to discriminate against boys with her school. There are other black Americans who are multimillionaires, but have not stepped up to lead the charge for black children to be given the education they need to be equal in America. The same is true of white billionaires and multimillionaires. Food stamps for these black children is important. But unless the mind is fed, their future is dim. We all hear the calls for equality. But as important as it is to reach equality for all Americans, it cannot happen until we realize the need to reach into our inner cities and provide for and assist upon the tools necessary to be equal to others. Here's an example for you. Let's say I drop out of school at 15 and run the streets, impregnate women, and thrive on government assistance while you do whatever is necessary to finish school. You work days and seek further education in night courses. How could we ever be equals? Yes, there are white dropouts too, but not nearly in numbers as great as among blacks. That's not meant to disparage black people. It's simply a fact we all have to deal with when the argument is made the black community goes into a defensive posture and strikes out at the person posing the question as a racist. Liberals do that too. We get nowhere with that attitude. The truth may hurt, but it's still the truth. White superiority is a myth. Given the same tools and assets, blacks can achieve the same levels as whites. My heart goes out to those newly freed slaves who stumbled out of the darkness without the tools and assets to compete. But much has changed since blacks were unchained from slavery. The taxpayers of America provide a free education for all through the 12th grade, and there are many ways to get money for higher education, even if it means student loans. Theoretically, a young person is required to remain in school until they are at least 16, but that theory is challenged every day by those who drop out and are left to dangle in society. That age should be increased to 18. And greater emphasis put upon enforcing it. Instead, too many people refuse to take responsibility for their own actions and choices in life. They want to blame someone else for their self-inflicted wounds. They want to throw bricks and shoot at the police and then complain when they experience police brutality. Walter E. Williams is a columnist for the Daily Signal and a professor of economics at George Mason University. He's also a black man. That needs not be said except in the context of his statement, which I will repeat word for word. These are not my words. They are from a very smart man. Mr. Williams said this: "While it might not be popular to say in the wake of recent social disorder, the true plight of black people has little or nothing to do with the police or what has been called systemic racism. Indeed, we need to look at the responsibilities of those running our big cities. Some of the most dangerous big cities are St. Louis, Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, Chicago, Memphis, Atlanta, Birmingham, Newark, Buffalo, and Philadelphia. The most common characteristic of these cities is that for decades, all of them have been run by liberal Democrats. Some cities, such as Detroit, Buffalo, Newark, and Philadelphia have not elected a Republican mayor for more than half a century. On top of this, in many of these cities, blacks are mayors. Often they dominate city councils. and they are chiefs of police and superintendents of schools. In 1965, there were no blacks in the U.S. Senate, nor were there any black governors, and only 6 members of the House of Representatives were black. As of 2019, there is a far greater representation in some areas. 52 House members are black. 9 black Americans have served in the Senate, including Edward W. Brooke of Massachusetts, Carol Moseley Braun and Barack Hussein Obama of Illinois, Tim Scott of South Carolina, Cory Booker of New Jersey, and Kamala Harris of California. In recent times, there have been 3 black state governments that were run by governors. The bottom line is that today's black Americans have significant power in all levels of government. Yet, what has that meant for a large segment of the black population? Democratic-controlled cities have the poorest quality public education, despite their large and growing school budgets. Consider Baltimore, Maryland. In 2016, in 13 of Baltimore's 39 high schools, not a single student scored proficient on the state's math exam. In 6 other high schools, only 1% tested proficient in math. Only 15% of Baltimore students passed the state's English test. That same year, in Philadelphia, only 19% of 9th graders scored proficient in math, and 16% were proficient in reading. In Detroit, only 4% of its 8th graders scored proficient in math. Only 7% were proficient in reading. It's the same story of academic disaster in other cities run by Democrats. Violent crime and poor education is not the only problem for Democrat-controlled cities. Because of high crime, poor schools, and a less pleasant environment, cities are losing their economic base and their most productive people in droves. When World War II ended, the population of Washington, D.C. was about 800,000. Today, it's almost 700,000. In 1950, Baltimore's population was 950,000. Today, it's among 590,000. Detroit's 1950 population was close to 1,850,000 people. Today, it's down to 673,000. The population of Camden, New Jersey in 1950 was nearly 125,000, and today, it's 74,000. St. Louis's 1950 population was more than 856,000. Today, less than 294,000. A similar story of population decline can be found in most of our formerly large and prosperous cities. In some cities, the population decline since 1950 is well over 50%, and that includes Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh. Academic liberals, civil rights advocates, and others blame the exodus on racism. They call it white flight to the suburbs to avoid blacks. But blacks themselves have been fleeing some cities at higher rates than whites. The 5 cities whose suburbs have the fastest growing black populations are Miami, Dallas, Washington, Houston, and Atlanta. It turns out that blacks, like whites, want better and safer schools and don't like to be mugged or have their property vandalized. And like white people, if they have the means, black people cannot wait to leave those troubled cities. White liberals and black politicians focus most of their attention on what the police do. But how relevant is that to the overall strategy? According to statistics, this year, 172 whites, 88 blacks have died at the hands of police. Let me give you that again. 88 blacks died at the hands of police. But 172 whites died that way. To put police shootings in a bit of perspective, in Chicago alone in 2020, there have been 1,260 shootings and 256 homicides, with blacks being the primary victims. That comes to 1 shooting victim every 3 hours and 1 homicide victim every 15 hours. 3 people in Chicago have been killed by the police. If only they were truly concerned about black deaths, shootings by police should figure way down on the list, which is not to excuse bad behavior by some black police, some police officers who are white and black. Again, those were the words of Walter E. Williams, a black professor at George Mason University. When such obvious truth is spoken, even by a black man, black America becomes defensive and doesn't want to acknowledge that truth. That's a human failing, but we have all sometimes exhibited it when confronted with inconvenient truth. There can only be real equality when we become equal. That is to say that if I won't put in the effort it takes to educate myself and seek opportunities, and you do, how do we ever attain equality? Racism is a complicated problem and can't be solved by telling us all to treat each other as equals. Can't we all just get along? Equality is earned. Equality is not just everybody being treated the same. Of course we should do that. But as long as some of us are not prepared to put in the work to educate ourselves and to develop work skills, there will always be inequality. That's true of whites as well as blacks. So why do I feel qualified to speak on the racism problem in America? I'll share something with you today that I rarely talk about. While I have not walked in the shoes of a black American, I have been closer to it than most people. The truth is that I have an uncle who is black. His name is Richard, and the family called him Little Richard because one of his sisters was married to an older white man named Richard. Little Richard was just 5 years older than me, and he lived with his mother, my grandmother, on a dairy farm near Brattleboro. Their housing was furnished by the dairy as a part of his pay for work in the dairy. He also got a small amount of money for that work, very small. After all, he had no bargaining power. He had to take what was offered. I never really knew how Little Richard came to be in our family on my mother's side. I heard different stories, but none were ever confirmed. Being close to Little Richard's age, I enjoyed spending weekends and weeks in the summer with him and my grandmother. Richard and I slept in the same bed at night. Little Richard was uneducated. He had not been accepted in the white school system, and he refused to admit he was black and enter the black school system. Given the way blacks were treated in those days, you can't blame him. It was a segregated society where people with black skin were considered inferior to whites. In any event, society just allowed him to fall through the cracks and be forgotten. I looked forward to every visit with my grandmother and Little Richard. We were inseparable. We hunted together and fished together. I'd get up with him at 4:30 every morning to help him milk the cows. I wasn't much help, and there were no milking machines in those days, so Little Richard milked the cows by hand and fed them silage by pitchfork. It was a boring and tedious job, but I never heard him complain. After the cows had been milked, we'd go back to the house at about 9:30, where Grandma had whipped up a log roller's breakfast. Later that day, we'd hunt or fish. Their little house was on the banks of the Tar River. Those were happy days, still etched in my mind from the time I was about 12 until I was 16. I'd head for Little Richard's house at every opportunity. I would have been 12 in 1954, a time when black oppression was at its peak. I'd go to a segregated school and then head for Grandma's house. I had no hand in segregation. I was just a young boy and powerless. My many experiences when Little Richard and I left the dairy property gave me insight into what it felt like to be black. I will not go into the many memories I have of racism of those days. It's painful to do so. If we went to a movie, an adult had to take us to a drive-in because the movie house was for whites only unless you wanted to be put in the balcony like an inferior animal. We learned quickly not to go there. Some stores would not even allow Little Richard to come inside. On those occasions, I'd go into the store, purchase what we wanted, and bring it out to share. How demeaning is that for a human being? I heard the N-word a lot when in town with Little Richard. Not necessarily in a harsh setting. It was just a common word used by whites in those days. Little Richard just let it pass. Me, not so much. But there was little I could do, and it would be dangerous to even try. Little Richard was very muscular. He had known nothing but hard manual labor since birth. His hands were hard and his back was strong, and that got him through until the age caught up with him. Eventually, he developed several maladies, his knees and back were shot, and he suffered multiple heart attacks. The only work he could do was unavailable to him because he had no education and could barely write his name. In old age, he wound up in a battered old mobile home in coastal Carolina, living hand to mouth. I was there in his younger days and a witness to the injustice he suffered. Still, to this day, there is no hate in his heart. American society failed Little Richard. North Carolina failed him, too. No one concerned themselves with the little black boy who wasn't in school. Don't tell me about racism. I've seen it up close and personal. Having said all that, the answer to our racial problems is not to be found in the streets carrying protest signs. Yes, we need to acknowledge that police brutality is a problem in America and that black lives do matter. But we also have to understand that far more whites have suffered death at the hands of police than blacks. Police brutality is not confined to black lives. White lives matter, too. It is a matter for both races to address. When I turned 18 in 1960, I volunteered for the Navy. Having come from a segregated background, this was a different world. Suddenly, we were in a world of diversity. Whites ate, slept, and worked with blacks, Latinos, and Filipinos. I was more used to that than most others because of my association with Little Richard. In the 9 weeks of boot camp in San Diego, there was never a harsh dispute between the races. We all had a job to do, and we had to depend on the others to help do it. The color of that help was irrelevant. That continued through my next naval assignment at Chase Field in Beeville, Texas. I have seen great progress in America since my birth in 1942. We still have much work to do to create the kind of society I believe the majority of us want to live in. Not just work by whites, but a recognition by blacks that much progress has been made. When I hear a black person condemn white people in America, I cringe. Have they forgotten that more than 600,000 white men gave their lives to free blacks from bondage in the Civil War? Are they to be forgotten? Are they willing to continue ignoring the problems in the black community as they blame whites for all of their woes? We all have to work to build a world where color of skin is no longer a criteria for hate. The sooner we get on with that work, the sooner we will have a society God expected us to have. Who's willing with me to try? You've got a bonus commentary today. I'll be back again on Friday, God willing. Same time, same station.